Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up today, a taste of Columbus and a toast to wonderful workplaces is happening this week. We'll learn more about the event and the group putting it on, the Columbus Young Professionals Club. I'll talk with Dr. Chaz Dabbs. He's a bariatric surgeon at Mount Carmel Hospital who has a great deal of knowledge about and insight into the obesity epidemic. And state politics with Doug Petcash of Face the State. This week, Doug interviews a political expert about Ohio's recent primary election, chats with some young voters about what's important to them as we look ahead to November, and we'll hear from an Ohio mayor who recently visited war-torn Ukraine. First up on Columbus Perspective, Derek Grosso. He is the CEO and founder of Columbus Young Professionals. They have been around for almost 20 years here in the capital city, and they are doing a lot. Derek, welcome to Columbus Perspective.
Excellent. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
We're excited to hear about all the great stuff that is going on with your group. And let's start with what's coming up most immediately, Thursday the 28th at a venue that is relatively new downtown, but I highly recommend checking it out. Perhaps this is the opportunity to do it. A Taste of Columbus and a Toast to Wonderful Workplaces with Columbus Young Professionals. Derek, what exactly does this event entail?
So, you know, if you're familiar with all the different restaurants or options to go out and enjoy Columbus and explore restaurants and bars and breweries and distilleries, you know, it becomes difficult sometimes, A, because life gets in the way, or B, because, it's not easy to get all over the place. And even if you do know about these places, there's so many new places that are opening. So putting them all under one roof, we have over 50 vendors who will be restaurants, bakeries, breweries, distilleries, and more, all giving the opportunity for attendees to sip, sample, and savor some of the best our city has to offer. So that's the Taste of Columbus portion. And we also combined it with a Toast to Wonderful Workplaces, which is an annual celebration of local employers who are basically rated as some of the best for young professionals or emerging talent to work for in the Central Ohio region. So we combine it as a taste and a toast. And that way people can enjoy cuisine, connect with other foodies, young professionals, really anyone of all ages, network with local employers, and experience one of our signature events.
I was going to ask, and you already answered that. You said all ages. When you hear Columbus Young Professionals, Perhaps the concern would be, what's the age limit? Can I get in? This event sounds delicious, but you're not going to discriminate based on age, or I'm sure anything else at this event.
Right. It's 21 and above because of the breweries, distilleries, and wineries that are going to be sampling. But it is an event for anyone who's young at heart. And so young professional, for our purposes, the Columbus Young Professionals Club, 21 through 45. So it's a pretty wide range, but everyone kind of has a feeling of when they're no longer a young professional. And so we let them decide.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Now, when you are toasting these workplaces at this event, do you have those different workplaces that you'd like to honor already selected? Is that going to be a surprise the night of the event?
It may be a surprise for some, but all of the honorees, we had a three-month period of nominations from anyone in the Central Ohio region. So they were CYP Club members. We worked with the Better Business Bureau of Central Ohio, the Human Resources Association of Central Ohio, a number of chambers of commerce that could send in nominations. And from there, we had a selection committee that viewed them on four areas: coolness, stickiness, so attraction and retention, opportunities for growth, and community impact. So what are they doing to grow their talent base, and what are they doing for our community? And so we've selected 25 wonderful workplaces in 2024. And they'll be unveiled that evening, but we will be sending out a special email to all of our members, which is a pretty large network. We've got over 20,000 members in CYP Club here in Central Ohio, but they'll all get access to knowing who they are, and then others will be a little bit of a surprise that night. So the honorees have been invited and bringing some of their HR departments or some of their wonderful young professionals and C-suiters together.
Excellent. The Columbus Young Professionals Club has been around, like I said, for nearly 20 years. And right here on their website, it says founded in 2005, The club has grown from a simple idea hatched by two friends over burgers into the nation's largest membership association for emerging leaders. That's pretty impressive. What was it? Were you one of those friends over burgers coming up with this
idea?
I was.
I was one of the founders. And, you know, a friend of mine, he grew up on the West Coast. I grew up on the East Coast. And we met in the middle in Columbus. And we're pretty sociable. We're looking to connect and network. But sometimes it's difficult when you're new. And even if you've lived here your whole lives, some people get inside of a bubble where they don't get outside their comfort zone. So, you know, the concept was really simple: provide an opportunity for people to have an outlet that was part social, part business networking, career oriented, part focused on giving back. So we have lots of volunteer programs. And actually we put together a few dozen recreational sports leagues throughout the year. So people can play volleyball, dodgeball, kickball, bowling, and make new friends. So I was the founder, and basically that simple idea continued to grow. And here we are now almost 20 years later with this really large organization that has done a lot in Central Ohio for many of its members and many people in the city. We've got some really cool impact that we've done that I'm very proud of, and we can talk about that as well. But it continues to grow, which is one of the really neat things. There are always people moving here. There are people graduating. There are people finding out about the organization. An event like this brings together people who are unfamiliar with an organization such as ourselves. And whether they're coming in to learn about some of the newest restaurants or breweries that are going to be featured here, they also get an opportunity to learn about a networking organization that's also social and philanthropic, that's also free to join. That's another real benefit of this organization. And, you know, they're connecting with other like-minded professionals.
Columbus Young Professionals, led by Derek Grosso, and there's a paid staff of just about a dozen people, right, Derek?
Yes.
And a lot of volunteers.
We have a lot. We have about 80 or so volunteers. We have a couple of different leadership groups. We have a leadership council, which is kind of like the eyes and ears. There are about 50 people on that leadership council, mainly young professional fellow members, folks who are doing really cool things. And then we have an advisory board that's made up of some seasoned professionals and C-suiters and folks in the human resources and diversity, equity, inclusion space that are helping to guide us. But all these volunteers help us steer the trajectory, but also host events like this. And so we have a host committee that's responsible for this, in addition to the selection committee that helped us with the wonderful workplaces, that's helping me put it all together. And then we have about a dozen or so event coordinators and athletic league coordinators and community engagement leadership program leaders who help us really take this organization and continue to expand it and bring it to the people, whatever they want, or however we can help.
In addition to events like A Taste of Columbus and the Toast to Wonderful Workplaces coming up this Thursday, tell me about some of the other activities. You mentioned recreational sports leagues. What other types of activities and different programming do you offer for young professionals?
That's a great question. We have lots of programming, one, because we have lots of members, but also we have a lot of different interests, and we want to welcome people with different interests. We want to welcome people who are like-minded. And in that regard, we're thinking community-focused and career-oriented. But even if someone's in transition or they've already got the organizations that they're wanting to give back and get involved with, it's also all about having fun and finding a sense of community. So a lot of the events that we do are focused on building community, bringing people together. We're wrapping up a program that we launched a few years ago next month called Crash Course Columbus. And then we'll do another session in about 6 months. But it's a program that allows new residents to get to know other new residents and kind of have a crash course in Columbus, from the parks and theaters to the nonprofit scene. And it's a 5-week program. And so we do programs like that. We have a leadership curriculum in the fall that's for emerging professionals. There's a cohort of about 40 or 50 people. It's called the Columbus Impact Academy. And we do happy hours, and we do, spirits and beer tastings. We have events for friends. We don't do dating events, Although we're not oblivious to the fact that members meet and find love through our events or organization, but we do speed networking and speed friending events, which are kind of the same concept, but are more activity focused on meeting friends, making new friends, or building your business network. That is more than just going to an open networking event where everyone's passing business cards and you're a little overwhelmed. So we really try to make it more focused on building community, but familiarity is important to us. Specifically, that's why we have so many people on our leadership council and our advisory board and our events team, because we want to represent our community and our members. We also want to have a lot of people that can connect with them that they can identify with.
We're talking with Derek Grosso. He's the CEO and founder of Columbus Young Professionals Club, the nation's largest membership association for emerging leaders. You can join for free. When they say young professionals, they mean basically the 21 to 45-year-old age range. But it's not like you're going to check an ID, right? Right, Derek?
That's correct.
We want
to make sure everyone feels welcome.
And that really is the overwhelming sense that I get from talking to you. And you mentioned a little bit ago that there's quite an impact that you've made on the community. I know that you have been, and your group have been, very active in philanthropic activities. Tell me a little bit more about what guides you in terms of what causes you look to support.
I think with the number of members that we have and the number of organizations that need help in the community, that's one of the things that we really look at, is where can we be of the most assistance? We certainly can double up or add resources for other efforts, and we do that often because it makes sense to collaborate. But a lot of times, you know, we want to say, okay, well, what can we do that's different that can help people in ways that they're not being helped? And we've created some programs and we've hosted some events that have been able to do that. One which is coming up in a few months. It's actually a new event. We host once a year for the last 10 years. We've hosted an event called the Columbus Volunteer Expo, which is a really great open networking trade show type event for individuals who are looking to volunteer to get involved with nonprofits, but get to know them rather than go to their website or maybe have the ability to talk to other people who've been involved with them. And so we're doing a similar event in the spring, because the Volunteer Expo is usually in the fall, called the Columbus Volunteer Festival. So Volunteer Fest will happen in May, May 23rd, and that will bring together a bunch of folks who are looking to get involved of all ages, and we'll have 40 or 50 nonprofits, we'll have food trucks and live music. So we'll make it a little bit more of a festival theme and a vibe. And of course, it'll be free to attend and folks can get involved in whatever they'd like. So those are some of the things that we look at in terms of helping the community in ways that we can, creating new or different platforms. But we've also been listed on Columbus Business First's corporate citizenship list for probably the last 4 or 5 years that they've been doing it. We were ranked the fifth most generous company, having donated $328,800 in kind to local causes in the past year. And that's something we're proud of, because we can help those organizations. We do a lot of donations. Over the years, we've had fundraisers that have raised collectively over $650,000 cash donations to local nonprofits. So we're interested in helping the arts. We're interested in helping animals, pet adoption. We're interested in helping kids and organizations that, you know, help the next generation of young people thrive in Central Ohio and beyond. And probably each year we donate about 5,000 volunteer hours. So there's a lot of different things that we do, and there are others that I can talk about, but you can obviously go to our website, cypclub.com, and learn more. We're just very member-driven and, like I said, community-focused. So folks can come in and suggest something, and if we can make it happen, we will.
That's a pretty impressive resume of giving back to the community, and it sounds like the honor from Columbus Business First is well-deserved.
Thank you.
A Taste of Columbus and a Toast to Wonderful Workplaces this Thursday evening at the Key event venue in downtown Columbus. As Derek mentioned, the website is cypclub.com. And if you would be interested in becoming a member of the Columbus Young Professionals Club, it is certainly an opportunity, like he's been saying, to meet folks that are also in a young professional space, like-minded, perhaps to get involved in some volunteering or some professional networking or even one of those fun recreational sports leagues. But what a great way to, pardon the pun, taste the Columbus Young Professionals at this coming upcoming event this Thursday. Check that out and so much more on their website. Derek Grosso, did we miss anything? It's a lot that you have going on.
It is. And that's why we keep doing it, because if there's a need, we want to fill it, and we're very creative, open, collaborative, entrepreneurial. That's how I am, and that's how I've always been, and that's how I lead the organization. But I would also mention that if you're interested in who's going to be at A Taste, you can go to our website, and we have a list of all 50, I think there are 52 restaurant food vendors, as well as the distilleries and wineries. You don't have to be a member to attend A Taste of Columbus. It's right now, tickets are $20, and it includes a 3-hour event with live music, the awards program. Also, as you're mentioning, the key, they have some really cool features inside of the venue, such as giant Jenga, giant chess games, virtual golf, and all that's going to be free and included part of the event as well. So there'll be things to do if folks are tasting, the food and drink vendors, and they want to, you know, kind of explore some other things too. So that's what we do. And that's what I love about Columbus, is there are so many things to do. And if you've got a group of people who are interested enough, you can really do some great things.
And this is one of them. A Taste of Columbus this Thursday evening at the Key. CYPClub.com is the website where you can get all of that information and check out that list of restaurants, breweries, distilleries, bakeries. You will be hungry by the time you finish that list. $20 is a very, very reasonable ticket price for this, and it sounds like a lot of fun. Derek, thank you so much for joining us today on Columbus Perspective.
It was my pleasure. I hope to talk to you soon, and I appreciate the opportunity to tell my story a little bit.
At first glance, Terrence and Shania have nothing in common. Terrence is a musician. He is constantly traveling. He is 32 years old, single with no kids, and started smoking when he was 16. Shania, on the other hand, just turned 45. She owns a coffee shop. She is married with 2 kids and has never smoked. What makes Terrence and Shania similar is that they both have been diagnosed with small cell lung cancer. And it was caught early. That's right. Small cell lung cancer can affect anyone. The good news is early lung cancer screenings can detect small cell lung cancer before it spreads, when the disease is most treatable. Join Stand Up to Cancer and Jazz Pharmaceuticals to raise awareness of small cell lung cancer and accelerate the pace of research. Ask your healthcare provider about screening options that might be right for you or a loved one. Visit standuptocancer.org/lung to learn more.
The next disaster is coming. The time to get ready is now. Make a plan. Choose meetup locations and keep a contact list. Build a kit with food and water. Don't forget your pets. Keep extra medicine on hand. Make copies of key documents and keep them somewhere safe. Stay informed, learn about local hazards, and sign up for alerts. Be ready. Learn more at americares.org/sendusin.
Find the Children is a nonprofit organization dedicated to helping find missing kids. You can be a part of their mission by donating your unwanted vehicle, running or not. Call 1-800-294-0222. We guarantee that you will receive the maximum tax deduction. We provide fast, free pickup with 24-hour response. Call 1-800-294-0222. Find the Children provides crucial resources to help find missing children and educational materials to teach kids how to recognize and avoid predators. Our recovery programs have a proven track record of reuniting kids with their families. It's time to act. Donate your unwanted or unused car. Help us build a world where every child is safe. Pick up the phone and call 1-800-294-0222. Together, we can bring these kids home safely. This advertisement was paid for in partnership with Cars R Us and Find the Children.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan.
I'm Kate Burdett, and it seems like every time you listen to a news story about health, it has something to do with obesity. Obesity is a big problem in our country. It leads to so many different complications for your health, like diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, sleep apnea also. It's estimated about 500,000 deaths per year
could be attributed to obesity. It's the leading cause of preventable death in the United States. And it can increase, obesity that is, can increase your risk of premature death by up to 250%. Like I said, it's a preventable cause of death. And because of that, we're talking today with Dr. Chaz Dabbs. He's a bariatric surgeon at Mount Carmel Hospital here in Columbus. His expertise and knowledge on this topic is ours to share for the next few moments. Dr. Dabbs, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
First off, I'm curious, what is your medical background in terms of your experience in the field, and what got you into the bariatric area of healthcare?
Sure. So I kind of came to my specialty as a surgeon through sort of a strange pathway. My background is actually in mental health. So I studied counseling and family therapy in college, and I planned to be a practicing psychologist, and just kind of fell out of love with that field and decided instead to go to medical school, thinking, you know, I'd try to find a different way in the world. And, you know, you don't go to medical school with that background and have people assume that you're going to wind up as a surgeon. But I loved surgery and doing that kind of work with my hands and, you know, being able to kind of create very efficient change and cure for my patients. So I wind up as a surgeon with a background in mental health care. And through a long series of very interesting happenstances and events, I wind up with a practice doing bariatric surgery. And I kind of feel like I'm right where I'm supposed to be, because I think the reality is that obesity and body image issues and mental health is so sort of inextricably entwined together that it's nice to, you know, be in a field where I'm still kind of using the background information and things that I learned way back in undergrad and letting that make me a better surgeon.
It sounds like a very sort of well-rounded approach to this specific field of healthcare. And before we go any further, I do want to kind of get your definition. When we say bariatric surgery, there's more than one option in that arena, aren't there?
Yeah. So, you know, for bariatric, you know, that word essentially is saying that we're treating obesity and then the metabolic and medical disorders associated with obesity. And then, you know, surgery, we're basically narrowing it down to focusing on the surgical treatments, though there certainly are other medical treatments for obesity that are becoming very popular and in the news right now quite a bit.
Those being things like semaglutide injections, the Ozempic that we hear about a lot from the celebrities.
Yeah.
Okay. And then when we get to the actual surgery, there's a difference between the actual mechanics, I guess you'd say, between, say, a gastric sleeve and a gastric bypass procedure. Can you kind of shed some light on that for us?
Certainly. So those are the two most prominently done surgeries in America and the rest of the Western world. They have different ups and downs, and a lot of people, you know, especially people who watch some of the TV shows that are sort of popular, there's a lot of oversimplification that's done in how to decide between one procedure or the other. But to try to keep it very brief, the sleeve gastrectomy is a restrictive procedure. So its primary function in helping people treat their obesity and metabolic disorders is by making the stomach much, much smaller, therefore creating restriction. So it's difficult to overeat, but also there are hormonal changes generated by removing that portion of the stomach that affect satiety, or the word we would use would be appetite. So it's kind of appetite suppressing and also makes it difficult to overeat as well. The Roux-en-Y gastric bypass is restrictive also because, again, we're changing the size of the stomach pretty considerably. But then it also has a component of malabsorption that is intentional, where we're essentially making it so that the person does not draw in all the nutrients, carbs, and fat from the things that they're eating due to the way that we've rerouted the intestines.
Both sound like pretty major procedures to have. Is that true, or are these procedures kind of evolving so that you can any of it be done on an outpatient basis?
Sure. So this is a question that requires some sort of subtlety to discuss, because to say that they're not major, you know, would make the bariatric surgeon sound like somebody who doesn't take their job very seriously. Mm-hmm. And I certainly do. And we focus on, you know, excellence and expertise in what we're doing. I think to speak about it correctly would be to understand that they're very common, and we have really refined our technique in order to allow these surgeries to be done quickly for the sake of the patients, so they're not spending a lot of time on the operating room table, and then getting people out of the hospital as quickly as possible, since being in the hospital is generally not most people's first choice, nor necessarily the safest place to recover from much of anything. Mm-hmm. And yes, we have started doing some bariatric surgeries as an outpatient even. This is done at some other centers in the country, and we are doing them as well.
And along with this, I think it's important to point out that these are not procedures that you can just call up, make an appointment, and have done. There is a lot of lead up to a potential bariatric surgery in terms of not just physical medicine, but also some counseling and other things that come into play to make sure that a candidate is the correct candidate for this type of procedure, right?
That's correct. You can't just sort of walk in and pull one off the shelf and have one. This is definitely something that takes consideration and prep. The reason that bariatric surgery is as safe as it is in this country is because of the excellent work done by a lot of people to create programs for how do we get, you know, the patient from walking in our door to surgery safely so that they can get a safe and also very effective outcome. So there is an entire process. It does a little bit change patient to patient, also depending on insurance company requirements. But we have mandatory psychological evaluation, dietary and nutrition classes, and follow-up available for all of those things as well.
Dr. Dabbs, what would you say, in your opinion, in your expert observation of American society and your work as a physician in this field, what would you say is responsible for sort of the seeming explosion of obesity rates in our country over the past few decades? It seems that we are just hearing more and more, and the numbers keep going up.
Sure. Well, this is a topic that there's a lot of discussion about. I don't know if anybody knows the exact smoking gun to point at, but I would actually blame the Industrial Revolution in Europe in the 1700s for being what really probably kicked off the obesity epidemic in the 21st century. The way the human body, you know, our genetics don't change that much generation to generation. It will take a long time for us to get used to a completely different lifestyle. And in the 1700s, you have the invention of electricity being used in people's homes and in businesses, the factory farm, the idea of third shift work, and motor vehicles all start to become developed. And then you get the second industrial revolution, where we really get cars coming off the line. And what that did is completely change the way humans as a species live. I mean, for our entire history of a couple hundred thousand years leading up until the mid 1850s, it took 90% of our population to generate the food required for us to sustain ourselves. now I saw a statistic somewhere, I'm sorry, I can't give you a reference, that it takes roughly 5 to 10% of our population to generate the food that we need to sustain our population, which leaves a lot of other time for people to do other things. And that's great. But we experience food in plenty, which is not normal for our genetic code. The animal that we were built to be is a hunter-gatherer on its feet, 18 hours a day, moving from place to place, trying its best to eke out an existence. And now, we don't have to walk places. We can ride places. We can work into the wee hours of the night rather than observing a sort of appropriate sleep cycle, which we know is definitely deleterious to our weight. We have the ability to have jobs where you sit all day. And again, for up until about 150 years ago, these things were essentially non-existent.
It sounds like life got easier and maybe a little too easy for some. And this is the price we're paying for it now.
Yeah, just different. Again, we're an animal, but it's built to handle a certain environment. And things have changed so rapidly. So, the phone, for crying out loud, the phone was basically the same invention from Alexander Graham Bell until 1982, when it became a wireless object. And now, the phone is just, to quote a comedian, Gary Goldman, the phone is just a seldom used app on my phone.
Dr. Chaz Dabbs is a bariatric surgeon at Mount Carmel Hospital here in Columbus, and his wealth of knowledge on the topic of obesity in America and now the really effective treatments that do exist for people who have tried weight loss methods that do not work for them, for people who are dealing with the major side effects that obesity can bring in terms of other health issues, comorbidities, I believe is what doctors call them, is really remarkable. Dr. Dabbs, what are some of the requirements for a person to even be eligible potentially for bariatric surgery?
Well, the current standards, which are probably going to shift somewhat over the next 5 to 10 years, would be for the patient to have a BMI of 40 or higher, or a BMI higher than 35 with obesity-related comorbidities. And those are specifically defined as high blood pressure, high cholesterol, obstructive sleep apnea, or type 2 diabetes.
That's a pretty daunting list. And I would imagine for someone in that position, again, who has tried, and certainly I would, venture to say, I'm sure you'd agree that our culture, our entertainment, we're constantly bombarded with images of bodies and ideal, supposedly, bodies and things like that. So that, that comes into play a lot. But for someone who is considering that maybe their option or only option right now is to look into bariatric surgery, what advice do you have for that person?
Okay. Well, you certainly touch on a big topic, because the whole idea of sort of body positivity and moving our culture a little bit away from sort of obsession with appearance is, very much kind of ongoing as we speak. And I would hope, I guess I would say, I never really would want a patient to be looking into bariatric surgery for that reason. So the question was, what is my advice? To focus on trying to gain health, that, this isn't something that you do. I can't be healthy. I've hit an age where I can't lose weight as easily as I used to, or whatever. I think that as we've talked, I hope you kind of get the fact that physically and genetically, we're fighting a bit of an uphill battle against our own creations and the lifestyle that we've sort of created as a culture. And that what I would want for people as advice to start is to just say why you're choosing this, and to choose it in an effort to live a healthy and more fulfilling life going forward. It has nothing to do with liking the way you look in the mirror. My hope is that my patients like the way they like what they see before surgery and like what they see after surgery, because at least in my experience, I don't think that people tend to make major life changes for the better from a place of shame or hating themselves. I want my patients to love themselves enough to make a major life change so that they can have a good and healthy life.
Dr. Chaz Dabbs, if you weren't with us earlier, shared that when he began his medical career, his medical education, he was focused on mental health. And I think that's extremely evident. What a wonderful attitude for you to bring to your practice and to your patients, because absolutely, it's not about how you look, it's how you feel, and it's about how healthy you are. Dr. Dabbs, I so appreciate your time today and your wisdom and knowledge on this topic. I think we could probably go on for many more hours, but but unfortunately, we are out of time. But thank you again, Dr. Chaz Dabbs from Mount Carmel's Bariatric Surgery Program.
That was my pleasure. Thank you.
What's this? A letter from the Selective Service System? Ah, now. Hey, Steve, it's me, Future Steve. You're me? Yes, and you need to register with SSS or we won't get our dream job in 10 years. Save our future.
If you're a man aged 18 to 25, visit sss.gov to register today. It's required by law, and it can open the door to many benefits like federal government jobs and training.
That was easy. Thanks, Steve.
This is Columbus Perspective on the Fan. Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's Doug Petcash from his Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10TV. Please note that this interview was recorded before the results of Tuesday's primary election were known.
And joining me now to discuss the Senate and presidential races is University of Cincinnati political science professor Dr. David Niven. David, thanks for being here.
Pleasure to be here.
So the winner of this race will square off against three-term incumbent Democrat Sherrod Brown in November. What do you think will be the key issue or issues once, you know, whoever it is that comes out of the Republican primary taking on Sherrod Brown? What's the key issue, do you think?
Well, I think for the Republicans, you know, they hope to ride that, you know, coattails of Republican success. You know, no Republican has lost a statewide race, you know, in Ohio in the last decade, except the Republicans facing Sherrod Brown. So, you know, they're looking to ride on that. I think the difficulty they're going to have is Brown is relentlessly focused on workers and the economy. And I think, you know, he'll look to put, you know, distance between his, you know, presentation and theirs. And I think, you know, they're unknowns relative to Sherrod Brown. Sherrod Brown is universally known. So they're going to work to, you know, be as little destructive to the already advantageous situation Republicans have.
They also seem to bring up they think that abortion is also going to be a big issue because of the stark contrast between Sherrod Brown and their positions.
Well, I think a couple things about abortion. You know, one, Ohio voters have shown, you know, absolutely what side they are on the issue. So it's going to be difficult for the Republican nominee to sell the idea that you Ohioans just voted to enshrine reproductive rights in the state constitution, but we want to overrule that at the federal level. That's going to be a hard sell. The other thing about abortion that's interesting is if you look at the counties that voted for reproductive rights in November, it's pretty much a blueprint for counties that Sherrod Brown could compete for and win. You know, that is basically the path to the way a Democrat wins. For example, every county from Toledo to the Pennsylvania border voted yes on reproductive rights. Those used to be Democratic-based counties. If Brown keeps them in the fold, that's a path to victory.
So how important is this race nationally and, you know, for the makeup of the Senate?
Well, nationally, this is probably the number one Senate race in the country. And, you know, Ohioans are used to being the center of the universe in presidential campaigns. We're not that anymore. But we are going to be the center of the universe in the Senate campaign. And you're seeing numbers, both parties talking about hundreds of millions of dollars going into this race. You know, $500 million is the potential total in a Senate race. I mean, this is going to be a saturation campaign on both sides.
So moving now to the presidential race and our primary, you know, as you mentioned, Ohio is used to being, you know, a really important state in the presidential races. This one was settled really early. We know it's going to be Trump v. Biden. How does that impact, in your mind, our Ohio primary in terms of interests?
Right. It's not a good thing in terms of getting, you know, turnout. I mean, certainly the presidential, you know, is the marquee race and the thing that brings people out. So when we have a competitive presidential primary, we get more voters. It's going to put a lot more pressure on those Senate candidates on the Republican side to identify people and get them to the polls. You know, on both sides, you know, these are symbolic votes. You know, this is not really, at this point, this is not really about choosing a presidential nominee for voters. It's really, you know, showing sort of, you know, the flag for your team at this moment.
Do you recall a race for president being set this early? Is it common? Right after Super Tuesday?
I mean, to be set on both sides is what's extraordinary. It's not uncommon, you know, incumbent presidents, sure. You know, almost always, you know, have this thing wrapped up before it gets started. But to have it settled on both sides is really pretty extraordinary. And the extra irony is, even though it's settled in terms of the vote, it's not really settled until those conventions happen. If either of these candidates, for any reason, isn't ready to accept the nomination, those delegates could go another way and choose a different nominee.
Let's talk about, let's do a little civics lesson, sure. I suppose. Republican voters, as I mentioned earlier, will find five presidential candidates on their ballot. And people can vote for any of them. So can you explain how that system on the Republican sure. side works?
Sure. The way the Republicans do it, it's just one statewide vote. Whoever gets the most votes gets all those delegates. And so, you know, they want to make it, you know, a pretty cut and dried result. If you can win the state, even if you won the state with 25% of the vote, you'd get 100% of those delegates. So in a competitive election, this is why you're seeing, you know, Nikki Haley, for example, in South Carolina, did not do well at all and wound up with almost no delegates even in her home state, because the way the Republicans apportion those delegates is very much oriented toward, let's get this over with and call somebody a winner.
So if somebody does still has already with early voting or still wants to vote for those other candidates, what would have to happen for that candidate not to accept those votes?
Right. So, you know, the way it works in Ohio, you can suspend a campaign. You can say you don't want to run anymore. But if your name's still on the ballot and you haven't officially withdrawn your candidacy, if you haven't written to, you know, the Secretary of State and withdrawn, then your votes count. So there won't be any kind of like marker next to Chris Christie's name saying, you know, this person is not actually a candidate. So this is very different. Down ballot, you'll find there are going to be a handful of candidates who've dropped out after after the petition period. And you'll get like a little notice if you go in and vote saying that those votes don't count.
So you'll get that on that.
Right.
On voting day.
Right.
It doesn't matter this year, I guess, but you mentioned the differences. What's the difference on the Democratic side for the president?
The Democrats reward winning congressional districts. So in Ohio, across Ohio's 15 congressional districts, if we had, for example, you know, a candidate win five of those districts and another candidate win 10, it's not a winner-take-all system. You would reward, you know, those successes at the local level. And the big difference is, in a competitive election, of course, the big difference is, you know, it's a little bit more, you know, inclusive. It would recognize somebody who won, say, a third of the votes is going to walk away with delegates in the Democratic system. The Republican system, they would typically get nothing at all.
And Republican, it's winner take all. All right. Dr. David Niven of University of Cincinnati, thank you so much for your knowledge and sharing the analysis this morning.
Always a pleasure.
All right. Take care.
There's danger out there. It lurks on highways and quiet neighborhood streets. It's more likely to kill you than a shark, and more terrifying than the biggest snake. Distracted driving claims lives every day. Every notification, swipe, social post, video, or selfie while driving risks your life. So while you might think public speaking or the zombie apocalypse is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward. Don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Crispy, faded, lit, baked, toasty, stoned, blazed, zooted.
When you're high, there are a lot of ways to say it. But there's only one thing you need to remember. Driving under the influence of marijuana is illegal everywhere. If you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
My name is Juanita Segura, and I was diagnosed in November of 2014 with non-small cell lung cancer. The first time I heard about biomarker testing was actually my husband. He just started researching about lung cancer.
And I found out about biomarker testing, and I'm like, why not? Let's try it.
I'm Dr. Jorge Gomez, thoracic medical oncologist at the Mount Sinai Hospital. Comprehensive biomarker testing is looking for either substances in the blood or mutations in some of the genes of the cancer cells that can help us identify special types of lung cancer that can be treated with what we call targeted therapies.
Letting my children know brought all of us a sense of hope, to give them hope that mom is going to be around to see you grow up. And I promised them that.
Ask your doctor about how comprehensive biomarker testing before treatment may help you and your doctor decide on the best treatment for you. Visit noonemissed.org for more.
A public service message from Longevity Foundation.
The leading candidates in the 2024 presidential election are old. President Biden is 81. Former President Trump, 77. Male life expectancy in America is less than 74, and polls show age is a major concern for voters. We've received multiple questions from viewers wondering what would happen if one of the candidates dies or drops out of the race. The answer depends on a lot of factors: where we are in the election cycle, state laws, party rules, and the Constitution. We'll walk you through all the scenarios using these sources. Let's break it down into five stages. During the primaries, at the conventions, after the conventions but before Election Day, after Election Day but before the Electoral College votes, and after the Electoral College votes until Inauguration Day. So first, what happens if a candidate dies during the primaries between now and June? Depending on the state, if the primary hasn't happened yet, they'll probably still appear on your ballot and could still win delegates. Newcomers could jump in the race via a write-in campaign if the state allows it. And if you already voted, the delegates won by the now-deceased candidate in your state could potentially become free agents, or in rare cases be reallocated to other candidates. That depends on state and national party rules. So if Trump or Biden dies during the primaries, it's possible another candidate could then secure the nomination, but not likely. If they don't, what happens gets determined in the second stage, the convention. The nominee is ultimately decided by convention delegates, and who they vote for is assigned based on the results of their state's primaries. But there are two scenarios in which delegates could be allowed to vote for whoever they want. The first is if no candidate has a majority after the initial vote, in which case all the delegates become free agents. The second is if their assigned candidate has died. In this situation, the parties would likely enact rules to free up those delegates. Living candidates would still keep their delegates. And when a delegate is up for grabs, anyone can vie for their vote, even if they didn't run in the primaries. The process, called a brokered convention, continues until someone gets a majority and becomes the nominee. Stage three, what happens if the nominee dies before Election Day? This answer is pretty clear. Both parties have a rule saying that their national committee, a group of a few hundred state and national party leaders, would hold a vote and pick the replacement. Okay, next, what happens if Trump or Biden dies after winning the November election? Stage four is between Election Day and when the Electoral College votes. This involves people, called electors, who are picked by their party, filing the official votes for the candidate who won the state. But in the event that candidate dies during this month-long window, it's an open legal question about who they're supposed to vote for. So state legislatures would likely have to pass new laws clarifying what electors are allowed to do. And finally, stage five. Things get a lot simpler if the president-elect dies after the Electoral College votes, but before the inauguration. In this case, the 20th Amendment to the Constitution is invoked. It states that if the president-elect dies before taking office, the vice president-elect will be sworn in instead. Afterwards, the new president would nominate a new VP, who would have to be confirmed by the Senate. With your Verify, I'm Casey Decker.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Much has been made of the ages of the two presidential candidates. President Biden is 81. Former President Trump is 77. I wanted to go to the other end of the spectrum and hear what's on the minds of some politically active young voters. Joining me now are Katie Sewer, a third-year political science and strategic communications major at Ohio State, and Cassidy Nelson is in her second year studying public health and political science. They both are members of the College Democrats at The Ohio State University. First of all, welcome to Face the State. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
So first of all, as younger voters, first of all, Katie, for you, what do you think of the ages of the presidential candidates?
So honestly, I don't think much of the ages of the presidential candidates. I think what I've been hearing on campus and what I personally believe is that we're more focused on the issues. So, you know, we look at these guys and we see one guy who wants to, he literally said it last night, protect reproductive rights and pass reproductive rights federally. And we see one guy who wants to ban abortion everywhere. And, you know, with what Ohio voters voted for and how Ohio students voted for issue one in November, the choice is pretty clear.
And how about for you as far as the age question, Cassidy?
I would say the same thing. I'm more worried about the issues that the age is. It's not really a big deal. Reproductive rights is very big with us, and we obviously think that despite their age, we really care about the issues that these candidates hold, and yeah.
So, Cassidy, for you, how old were you when you got interested in politics?
I was about 16, so halfway through high school.
Yeah, and that's still carrying over now. What keeps you interested, or why do you want to be politically active?
Definitely just the issues. I definitely think, like with College Democrats at Ohio State, we do a lot with educating college students about the issues and, you know, meeting representatives and senators. And so that's just really big for us.
And learning the process as well,
yeah,
and what it takes to govern. And how about for you, Katie? How old were you when you started, you know, finding an interest in politics?
I was in eighth grade. It was right when Trump was elected. And I just remember watching the Women's March and all the protests, you know, when he did the Muslim ban and all those protests. And I just remember seeing people who were like my age or looked like me really standing up and fighting back. That's what really got me into politics. And what keeps me here is, like Cassidy said, the issues, absolutely. But also seeing our young people, especially our College Democrats members, engage in politics and getting to create those moments where maybe someone has never had a representative they feel like speaks for them before. And then they come to Ohio State and then all of a sudden they get to meet somebody. That's what also keeps me in there.
And also, do you feel it's important, you know, whether you're Democrat, Republican, Independent, to be involved in the system?
Oh, I think you should absolutely be involved no matter what party you are. I think it's up to all of us to, you know, take a really active stance on the issues. Young people have always been the ones who are really working to change the country no matter what side they're on. So I think no matter what side you're on, it's absolutely important to be engaged.
You've mentioned some of the social issues both of you have. How about other issues? What stands out to you that you want to hear candidates talk about you know, outside of perhaps the reproductive rights that you've talked about?
So obviously everyone talks about the economy, you know, it's the economy, stupid. And I think for younger voters, we want to hear our candidates talk a lot about jobs, because I personally, and I know many of my friends in College Democrats, we want to stay in Ohio. We love it here, but there might not be jobs waiting for us. And so I think that's something that young people are really interested in.
How about for you, Cass?
For me, it'd be affordable healthcare. As a public health major, we talk a lot about health insurance, and it's definitely something that it's a growing concern. I know President Biden recently set a cap on the cost of insulin, and so just stuff like that, making healthcare more affordable at the state and national level.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, as you're a second year, so you've got a little ways to go before you enter the job market. What is maybe one of your big concerns as you look ahead to that next step?
I probably want to stay in Columbus, and obviously the cost of living is increasing. Mm-hmm. So just being able to get out of college, go to graduate school, and still be able to afford it.
So you have a longer-term education plan, too?
Yeah, I want to go to law school. So.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Okay. How about for you, Katie, in terms of, you know, what are the concerns? You're a year ahead of Cassidy right now. What are you thinking about as far as what concerns you about your next step in life?
Well, you know, I think affordable housing is always something that is on the mind. You know, I really like it here in Columbus, and I really want to stay, but obviously I want to make sure that there's a place for me to live that, you know, is on an entry-level salary is okay. And then another thing I'm thinking about a lot is I have lots of friends like Cassidy and other people who are like public health, political science, and biology majors, lots of folks who want to be doctors. Mm-hmm. And right now with the attacks on trans kids in the state, the attacks continuing on abortion in the state, some of them don't feel like they can practice here. And that's really sad. And I don't want them to leave because they're my friends, but I also want them to stay because they are incredibly talented people, and I want to make sure we retain them. So making sure we retain that talent is really important.
On the flip side of that coin, then, what do you see perhaps as the opportunities that exist here that you'll be able to go after?
Definitely. So I think Columbus and Ohio as a whole is really growing. Mm-hmm. We have the Intel plant coming in. I think that's going to create a ton of new jobs in like engineering fields that are really, you know, kind of require those advanced degrees. I think Columbus, you know, we talk about affordable housing. We do need to make sure we keep an eye on that, but it still is, compared to like New York, affordable.
Yeah.
I think that's something. And I think the university is really something that is an opportunity here. I mean, there are so many people I know who are recent grads who are like, oh, I'm from New Jersey, I'm from New York, and I came here to go to Ohio State and didn't leave. And so I think we need to make sure we're sort of harnessing that talent and giving them a reason to stay.
And how about for you, Cassidy? What excites you about the possibilities in the future?
Definitely staying in Columbus. OSU Law School is amazing. And if you're interested in politics, there's a lot going on. We have, you know, the state capitol. So, of course, just staying here, hopefully with affordable housing. But basically everything Katie said, hoping all of my friends can also stay here and want to stay here. With that being said, obviously, the attack on reproductive rights and trans rights is definitely a concern. So, yeah.
But economically speaking, you're hoping both to stay here and make a life?
I would say so.
Yeah. Yeah. So we just have a couple seconds left. But what's your focus over the next 2 years in terms of school and then beyond?
Oh, my goodness. That's a big question. So definitely graduating, you know, passing all my classes. But I'm really focused on, you know, the 2024 election, getting our College Dems members engaged, getting them ready to go. You know, we see every time we do an event with Senator Brown that our members are super fired up and have so much energy. So just harnessing that energy, making sure that they are ready to hit the doors and win the state back for Sherrod Brown.
And how about for you, Cass?
Yeah, definitely in the next 2 years. This year is a very important year in Ohio. Obviously in the primaries, but as we get into November, we have a lot of Supreme Court seats up for grabs, and we're really hoping the Democrats can flip the court in Ohio, and just really focusing on getting the College Democrats engaged, and then obviously going to law school when I graduate.
You got a lot on your plate for sure as college students, but thank you both for sharing your insight and ideas and opinions on where the country is and the issues that are important to you. So thanks for coming in today.
Definitely. Thanks again
for having us.
The mayor of Athens, Ohio, Steve Patterson, recently got back from a trip to Ukraine. He was there for 8 days, partnering with an organization that works with the U.S. Agency for International Development. During his time there, air raid sirens went off while he was getting ready to talk with students at a university. Patterson says seeing the effects of the war firsthand was emotional for him. 10TV's Tara Jabor talked with Patterson about his unforgettable trip.
The air raid sirens went off, and we ended up having to continue our engagement in an air raid shelter.
Steve Patterson says for him, the sheltering was a lot of unknown, but for the students there, it was routine.
For them, this has become an everyday or every other day occurrence over in Ukraine, to where their lives are disrupted by having to shelter underground.
He spent about an hour in the shelter, and while they weren't hit at that time, he did worry about hearing the sirens blare again.
It certainly weighed on my mind while I was over there. It weighed on my mind often when I was going to sleep at night, because the air raid sirens can go off at any time.
He says seeing the strength of the Ukrainian people was special.
They love their country, and they will do anything to defend their country.
Patterson says one thing he kept hearing over and over during his trip was that people were thankful for the U.S.'s funding to aid those in Ukraine.
Extremely appreciative, stating that that this would have gone in a very different direction had the U.S. not helped in the way that they had. But they would also like to see continued funding coming to their war effort.
He's sharing his story about Ukraine to lawmakers in D.C. in March, encouraging them to continue sending money overseas. When he came back to the U.S., he couldn't get the struggle of the Ukrainian people out of his mind.
It was hard. I was pretty emotional, to where I just keep thinking about what they're having to deal with, the challenges that they have to work their way through day after day.
Tara Jabor, 10TV News.
Mayor Patterson says he plans to visit Ukraine again later in the summer.
Again, that's Doug Petcash, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10TV, from his Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan, heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS AM. That's 1460 ESPN Columbus. And Sunday morning at 7 on WBNS FM, Sports Radio 97.1, The Fan.